Hello and welcome to Future Projection. This is episode 146 of the show. I am Carlos Collazo, joined by Ben Badler, and happy Thanksgiving week to everyone. We're doing a podcast a little bit earlier this week during the holiday week, so hopefully we can catch you guys before your travels for the holiday, maybe make the travel a little bit better than it otherwise would have been with an early podcast. So we got a fun mailbag special coming to you. How are you doing today, Ben?
Yeah, good, Carlos. Yeah, we got a bunch of our, we've been doing the top prospect shows or top 10 shows for the each division, but taking a little hiatus or a little pause this week to, I know we haven't done the listener questions at the end of those 2+ hour episodes each week. So going to take a pause while we wait for the rest of the AL East top 10s to go up and try to get to as many of your guys' questions as we can.
Yeah, I think mailbag episodes are fun too. It's always nice just to have some interaction with the listeners. We've got some good prospect-oriented questions here as well. We've got some holiday-oriented questions as well. I don't know if you have a preference for tackling any of those first or if you've got anything else you want to mention before we get into the questions, Ben. But I guess I will just maybe point out that on the site, we're currently running the biggest sale that I can remember us doing, the biggest sale we'll have this year. It'll still be running when this podcast airs. So if you want to resubscribe to Baseball America, if you've been listening to the podcast and you've like thought about subscribing in the past, but you haven't pulled the trigger for whatever reason, I would definitely take advantage now because I believe through Cyber Monday, you can get 40% off on a Baseball America subscription. So go to store.baseballamerica.com. You can check that out. I'm not sure if there's a specific code involved with that, but everything should be pretty clear and obvious on the site if you check it out. So just plug in that big sale because we don't do them often. And with all the prospect content coming out over the past month and into the next few months, it's probably a good time to do it. So just point that out.
But if people want to pay 30% more, is that an option?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you can click add a tip for Ben and Carlos for for all the free podcasts over the years. Maybe we should have a special code where you can pay more. See how many we get from that.
Make a donation to charity instead, please.
Okay, let's ease into the mailbag questions, Ben. I'm gonna start with a softball here and stick on our holiday theme. We got a bunch of questions from Travis on Blue Sky. One of his is very much Thanksgiving themed, and he asks, which dishes are you most looking forward to, your 80 grade dishes, and which dishes would you not touch, your 20 grade dishes? He also asked where we slot in turkey compared to other meat and proteins on the 20-80 scale. And Travis himself puts turkey at a 30. Sounds crazy to me, but maybe it's not. Where are you at? Top of the scale, bottom of the scale, Thanksgiving foods, Ben, what you got?
Well, I'll start. I'll give you credit because we do evaluate everything on the 20-80 scale. I don't know if people realize that anything, probably from listening to us enough, you realize it. But we don't go five stars or A, B, C, D,
no,
F, no. Everything we talk about, the brisket was a 55, but the mac and cheese was a 40.
Me and all the Zoomers on staff are ranking energy drinks on the 20-80 scale. This is definitely what I feel like. Once you're exposed to the 20-80 scale, you just realize how much better it is than 1 to 10. I don't know if we've talked about this on the show, but if you use a 1 to 10 scale to rate things like most people do, the default, I feel like you basically never hear anyone using 1 to 5. Like that portion of the scale is almost thrown out entirely.
And you know, 5 stars, that kind of thing, no?
Maybe 5 stars is different, but just purely 1 to 10 scale, I feel like everyone is biased towards 6 to 10 and people hand out 7s like they're candy, like everything is a 7. And so then you have 8 to 10 to differentiate what's truly great and it's not enough room. And, you know, 6 is above average on that scale, but people use 6 as if it's like a D in school or something. So I don't think it gets used appropriately. 20, when you position yourself mentally to say, hey, we're starting at a 50. If it's good, it's going up. If it's bad, it's going down. You get a better, we want standard distributions here. That's what we're going for.
We like to go into detail too. Like it was the, you know, it played up because of this or that. So I think, yeah, the turkey is a skill issue there if it's a 30. That's a development issue for for the cook, which, I mean, no shade. I'm not cooking the turkey here either. Nobody wants to eat that, but that's like, you know, somebody drafting Paul Skeens and then saying like, hey, you know, you used to catch some, right? Like maybe take a break from pitching or
I've seen him in BP one time hey, we want that bat in the lineup.
Yeah, or saying, hey, Bobby Witt Jr., like, you're really fast. Maybe you should hit more balls on the ground. So I think that comes down to a matter of preparation to me.
Yeah.
I
mean,
if you have
so
really
your
good
player
turkey,
development lever here. I also just don't want to grade it on a meat protein scale. Like, I want the turkey on the Thanksgiving food scale. Like, let's just throw it into every other food here. I would say, like, for Thanksgiving, turkey is going, like, at the 50 or 45 line for me. It is the focal point of the plate, but it is never what I'm most excited about, ever. But it's also never what I'm, like, not putting on my plate at all. Like, I'm always putting it there. So I feel like it's the solid average tool for me.
It's a solid
everyday player.
If you're grading it against other meats, like, yeah, I guess, yeah, that's true. Like, I'd rather have a steak than turkey.
Agreed.
Other days of the year. But I'm not looking to eat steak. Although some people eat like a prime rib, maybe on
that is common. Yeah, I don't know if it's common, but it is something that happens. Yeah,
yeah.
For our Thanksgiving scale, what are you putting turkey? What's your grade? I'll go solid 50. Maybe that's boring.
If you do it right, the dark meat should be a 60.
Okay. So you're going 60?
Oh yeah.
Okay, 60 for you. I'll go 50.
When done right.
Caveat: when done. If you get in a great player development system. 60.
I mean, you can have mac and cheese could be a 70, but it could be a 40.
Let's assume it's prepared. Everything is prepared ideally. You still have different gradations of like where you personally are putting these foods on the scales. I could acknowledge if you just burn the mac and cheese, maybe it's 20. Like, I'm not going to eat it, but we have to assume some sort of baseline for preparation here. I feel like to make the. Because you could also say like some of the worst items prepared perfectly versus like the best items prepared terribly could vary. So I feel like we need some sort of normalization here for how the food is prepared. Let's assume a 50th percentile outcome for the prep of all the food.
I'd go if they're well prepared, I'll go 60 for turkey, for mac and cheese, for mashed potatoes, for like a good sweet potato dish too. Mm-hmm. And that could play up if it's really well done with the sweet potato dish.
Okay. I'm way lower on the sweet potatoes than you, but this is just a sweet potato thing with me. I feel like sweet potatoes is a little iffy. I'd rather just have regular potatoes. The regular mashed potatoes on Thanksgiving would be a 70 for me. Well-prepared mashed potatoes, 70. Mac and cheese, 70. You know what my 80 might be? You haven't mentioned it yet. A good stuffing or dressing,
yeah.
Either or. I think that's going to be my Thanksgiving meal 80.
And it's a very Thanksgiving specific dish too. Like, you're not out stuffing.
Right.
Okay. Like, let's go grab some lunch, Carlos. Where do you want to go get some stuffing? Like, no, that's.
Do you know my sneaky other? It's at least a 70, maybe an 80. The day after turkey sandwich for Thanksgiving. Is a super high upside play for me. That's maybe as exciting as the meal itself for whatever reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, to me, anything with vegetables in it on Thanksgiving is like a 20 or a 30. I'm not here on Thanksgiving for vegetables. It could be a fine dish. You can make it well. I'm not here looking to eat vegetables on Thanksgiving. I'm here looking to stuff my face and just be gluttonous. That's what makes Thanksgiving, like, everything kind of plays up on Thanksgiving sometimes. I feel like if it's more of a kitchen sink attack where just pile it all on the plate. I'm not here looking to eat broccoli or green bean casserole or anything like that.
I will say the green beans or a green bean casserole I like having on the plate. Because it just switches up the overwhelming beige that your plate turns into if you don't have any vegetables. But I will throw corn or any sort of corn side will be my 20 for these purposes. I never get it. I'm not wasting any space in the stomach on a corn-oriented dish. Everything else is better. But I do think green beans or a green bean casserole has a role on my squad. It's going to make the roster at least.
Yeah, give me corn. like Give me 5, 6, 7 different pitch shapes and pile them all on my plate. That's what that's what makes everything play up. I like. Do you have a dessert in mind or anything in particular?
I'm pretty default standard here. The last few years we've done like apple pie and vanilla ice cream, and I feel like that's just a classic. I do feel like if you have someone, like we've been away from family, so we've had like a pretty minimal Thanksgiving the last few years. Just with some work stuff going on with Maddie, but I feel like if you can get around family members who are making homemade pies, really whatever pie you're having has a chance to be a 70. Like a good pumpkin pie is good. A pecan pie is
pecan
good.
Pecan pie, yeah. Because you're not having pecan pie other times of year,
it's,
I don't think.
It's like stuffing. It's like the cranberry sauce. It's like you're never getting it outside of this week, so...
A good pecan pie, 60. The apple pie with the ice cream is a good one. It just it feels
vanilla ice cream. Yeah,
it feels so American when you're eating it. Yes. Like this is my culture right here.
100. Okay, we haven't mentioned cranberry sauce, gravy, and whatever roll that you're doing. Where are these meals for you?
The rolls are a good complimentary piece. It's like you want to eat them, but then you're like, I don't want to, you know,
they fill you up a lot quicker than you'd want, but I can't resist them. So
no willpower. We're not here for willpower.
Do you guys do a specific roll every year? Because we have become a Sister Schubert's roll family, and I will proselytize for Sister Schubert's rolls.
I cannot tell you the name brand of our
rolls, then Carlos. You're not getting to the 50 line for your rolls if you don't know what they are. Okay, fair enough. I would recommend that one for you if you still need to pick up some rolls. Sister Schubert's, go out and grab them. How about drinks? Any Thanksgiving drink? Or are you just doing water,
beer, wine? Are you a sweet tea guy? Is that what's going on?
I used to be like, I really do love sweet tea, but I try not to drink it anymore, unfortunately. I mean, objectively, it's the best flavored drink to go with all this. Just the salty sweet combo is perfect, but you just feel horrendous afterwards. When I was a kid, or like even just like late teens, early 20s, I would have like 4 or 5 glasses of sweet tea across Thanksgiving meal. And I would not want to do that right now at all.
I remember the first time having sweet tea when I was, when I moved down to North Carolina, I was like, do you guys really drink this?
Don't tell me it was like backyard barbecue pit sweet tea too. Cause that one has like, I don't know, like half the content of those cups are sugar. So
it might've been it probably was a Cushack or somewhere.
Cushack is pretty sweet as well.
Yeah. Not for my Massachusetts taste buds.
Anytime I'm in the North, I don't know if this has changed. I don't drink sweet tea anymore, so it's not much of an issue, but they never actually have just sweet tea. They'll have iced tea, and if it's a flavored tea, it's always like a berry-flavored tea. I'm not a fan of those, but we're kind of straying off the course of our Thanksgiving. I think we've gotten, given our grades, any other meals that we just forgot about entirely? Any other dishes?
There's a number of permutations you can go through, I think.
All right. Well, that'll have to pacify us for at least now. Curious if anyone has any hot takes on their Thanksgiving food grades, what they might be. But I think that's really all we have for Thanksgiving specific. We are going to talk prospects today in the mailbag. We got a lot of fun prospect-oriented questions. You can either pick or... We can just go down the list. How do you want to do it, Ben? We haven't done a mailbag only episode in a while.
I'll do one here. Devin, one bad neighbor on X asks, the term hitterish comes up when you guys are discussing some prospects. Could you both define what it means to you? You want to take that one, or do you want me to hit that one, Carlos?
I'll give you what I think of when I think of hitterish. When I say hitterish, almost probably just translates to a player I think has a good hit tool, like a player who, when I watch them, they're frequently getting hits. They're making a lot of contact. They have like impressive barrel adjustability. They get the barrel to different areas of the zone. It really just translates to players that I'm confident in or have seen them showcase their pure hitting ability. So bat to ball skills, hitting the ball in play. Like I would probably always use this to describe someone who uses the entire field as well. Like, I don't know that it has to be only all fields, but when I think of the players who I have described or would describe as hitterish, it has that trait to it as well. So not like if you're extremely pull heavy as a hitter, I'm not sure that I would describe you as hitterish. And maybe this excludes some hitters that I think probably do have a 60 hit tool, but I just wouldn't use that term maybe naturally for them. Maybe other people would, but for me, I do think of like an all field sort of approach, a lot of contact skills, and just a good ability to get the barrel on the baseball against a variety of pitch types. And if I'm using it, it's like it might also come with the context that I've personally seen this player perform in front of me as well. Although even that last one, I'm not entirely sure because I haven't seen every player that I think fits that label. So it's not like exclusively I have to have seen them perform, but those are some of the traits that I would say are a hitterish guy for me. How about you?
Yeah, it's part of our made up baseball lexicon, like pitch ability. That's not a real word, but it has meaning in the context of what we do. When I say a player is hitterish or looks hitterish, what I mean is that the guy does things consistent with what you see from good or great major league hitters. It's often an aesthetic thing, although it's functional as well. So it's typically going to be a hitter who has a more, like a nice, compact, clean swing, good bat path, usually somebody who has good balance, rhythm, timing at the plate, somebody who typically has adjustability to their swing too, so you're able to read and react to different pitches, different types of pitches in different parts of the strike zone, and get the barrel to the ball. So it gets used as this kind of catch-all term for basically hitters who just check a lot of boxes that you're looking for and do things that are consistent with great major league hitters. Obviously, when we're writing a scouting report or if we're breaking down a player in more depth on the show, we're going to go into more detail and describe in more specificity what we're looking at in that specific hitter that makes him hitterish. But it is a useful shorthand just trying to convey a lot of information or just paint a general picture for a player using a broad umbrella term like that.
Is there a player that comes to mind most loudly for you right now when you hear the word hitterish? Like if I said, Ben, who's a hitterish prospect, who's the first player you would think of?
On the prospect side, I mean, I'd say obviously Kevin McGonigal with the Tigers, J.J. Weatherholt.
Those are the exact two Cardinals, I would say.
Colt Emerson with the Mariners.
Do you feel like, so because those are the three players you mentioned, and I don't want to shortchange them in the power department, but do you think that the term hitterish has any sort of, do you think it speaks to power at all? Or do you think it's almost entirely the pure hit tool element? Because I would say as well, when I think of a player who's described as hitterish, it's almost always a hit over power type. And I'm not sure if that's just because some of the aesthetic traits we're talking about or some of the skills we're talking about just lend to that tier of player. But I don't think of a lot of power oriented or even like power equivalent sort of hitting profiles when I think of hitterish.
Probably because we just generally would use a different term to describe that player just being such a complete offensive threat.
Like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. certainly has everything you would, all the contact elements, but like if you describe Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as hitterish, I would probably be like, huh?
Well, he's just such a dynamic hitter. I mean, would you call, like you could call Miguel Cabrera or Manny Ramirez. Right,
like I wouldn't think of either of those as hitterish, but like they, I think it's just the power component that throws me off a little.
To me, power, like you don't even have to have power unless you're just like a total slap hitter. Like that's kind of a different profile. To me, when I think like, and I don't know the statistical breakdown of how often we use the term for lefties versus righties, but I imagine we probably use it a lot more.
I always picture lefties.
Left-handed hitters. But you know, you think of players like Joe Mauer or Christian Yelich.
Right.
Rafael Devers, Juan Soto, I would note, like Devers obviously and Soto have power, but I would characterize them, especially when they were younger, as hitter-ish guys. From the right side, I would say not current day, but a peak Anthony Rendon. I know he's everybody's punching bag right now. Right. There's a reason people are so, especially Angels fans, are dissatisfied with him, because he got that big contract because he was a great player. Mm-hmm. He's a consistent 5-6 WAR player when he was, you know, in his prime with the Nationals. But Michael Brantley, you know, you got guys where you see their swings and you're just like, yes, 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 mm-hmm. I like that. Put that in your hitting textbook of how to, you know, how to teach young hitters how to swing.
Yeah, the most hitterish right-handed hitter I can think of is probably Jacob Wilson. But I definitely tend to just think of left-handed hitters naturally for this sort of descriptor. It's
often guys too where you watch them and they just seem to see the ball extremely well. They read it out of the hands early. They track pitch mm-hmm. as well. And you don't want to go overboard with this, but I think there are times where you can get a lot of information about a hitter just from the way that he takes pitches, the way that they're able to stay balanced, how they react to breaking balls when they're not swinging at those pitches.
Like, do they look surprised in the box or not?
Yeah, you can get a pitcher throwing a sharp curveball to two different hitters and neither one swings, but one guy takes it and he's balanced and he's still in good hitting position. And you can see that he's recognizing the spin out of the hand early and just very quickly processing that information. Whereas the other type of hitter on that same pitch, you know, even if he's not swinging, you still see him flinch or sometimes just an all-out buckle, but something where you can see, hey, like, he's not recognizing spin that well. And then when they do swing, you know, you have one hitter who seems like they're always caught in between, even if they're making contact and their timing seems off compared to other guys where they just always seem to be in sync. They always seem to be on time, on plane, you know, two obviously huge keys for being a good hitter. And those are the players who tend to have a more hitterish look to them.
Yeah, I feel like the term is probably one of the most complimentary descriptors we have of a player. I'm trying to think of others that maybe would fit in the same bucket, but we're almost always really excited about a guy that we're throwing that sort of label on.
I would say a couple more things too, that not everyone who looks hitterish is actually a good hitter.
Speak more on that.
There are guys where I've seen where I'm like, man, that guy's got a really, really nice swing. Oh, yeah.
I'm having a couple come to mind too. Like, it looks like it should work. And in BP, everything looks great. Like, the swing is aesthetically pleasing. Mm-hmm. Like, the bat speed seems solid, but looks like they never perform. Yeah.
Yeah. Then in the game, they can't hit it. And it might be a lack of bat speed. It might be an issue with pitch recognition or plate discipline or just a lack of hand-eye coordination, some combination of those factors. But there are times where either you just get fooled by those players, or I might say even that, hey, this guy looks hitterish, but I don't. You know, but it isn't actually a good hitter when it matters. Like,
it's like a player who's fast, but his game speed for whatever reason doesn't translate. Kind of like that.
Like a fast, like an 80 runner who can't play center field. to me, I actually think so. Those are some of the most frustrating guys.
Yes, swing will break your heart, Ben. 100%.
I feel like it's such a waste. Like, which maybe isn't rational. Like, it's, but a hitter with who can't swing is always just so disappointing to me. I always feel so let down.
Yeah, and you're just like, what exactly is the reason it's not happening? You know, like, you're constantly trying to figure out why isn't it working? If you can point to so many other players who maybe just have a much uglier operation that shouldn't work but does, you're like, okay, but then there's this guy with the textbook pure swing, looks the part, does it all at 5 o'clock, and then the game comes around and he never hits. Yeah, that's always a struggle.
Yeah, and then you have the other side of it, which is there are guys who don't necessarily look hitterish, but are still good hitters.
Hunter Pence, like there are guys, Gavin Fien.
Yeah, I think there are guys, to me, like you said, you know, hitterish guys, generally someone you would give a plus hit grade to. Like, I think there are guys I would not describe as hitterish who can still be plus hitters where, hey, like the swing is unorthodox, but they might just have great hand-eye coordination. They have the type of bat quickness or bat speed that helps them make up for some deficiencies.
Right. Like, I wonder if anyone, and this is kind of going back to my power component, but like Aaron Judge is one of the best hitters in baseball history. I wonder if he has ever been described as hitterish. I bet probably not.
Probably not. No, because he's also hits 50 to 60 plus
home runs
a year. He's one of the best offensive players or just players overall of our generation. But yeah,
there does seem to be some power threshold where, like, even if you hit all of the qualities we're talking about for the swing, for the contact, for like everything we were talking about for hitters, it does seem like if there is a certain power threshold that you've reached, for whatever reason, that term is not something we're reaching for. Like Freddie Freeman, would you describe him as hitterish? I think he might be the guy who I definitely would, but he has great power. Yeah. And I think it's because of the aesthetics of the swing, maybe.
I think that's part of it. It's just the contact too. Like Judge strikes out more. And when you have, I mean, you think about the players in the history of baseball who ever had more power than Aaron Judge, it's a pretty short list. So there's a pitcherish corollary too that I've heard a scout
pitcherish
one time. Yeah, he used the term pitcherish. He's like, hey, we say all the time how guys look hitterish. He's like, I think about guys, whether guys look pitcherish on the mound. I was like,
interesting. I've not really heard that one too much.
I was like, I get it, I guess. I mean, you're getting in even more nebulous territory with our vernacular, but I get it. Yeah. Like the operation, the delivery, the arm action, the touch and feel, the ability to manipulate the ball, like guys who are more pitchers than throwers. So it doesn't really matter, I guess. Like, you know, ultimately we want to break these guys down into more detail, but it is sort of one of these catch-all terms that we throw out there.
I like, this is obviously very biased, but I like baseball jargon. I think it's fun. I think it just gets to something very concisely that you can communicate to people if you know what they mean or not. But it is, I mean, it's just interesting too to think of like someone maybe listening to the pod and not really knowing. Because I don't know in the time that I've been here if I've ever sat down and like asked, like, hey, what do you mean by hitterish? Just one of those things that gets thrown out and kind of assume everyone knows what you're talking about.
People wondering if we just glitched or something.
Just fun to actually get into the weeds on it and break it down. Okay. Yeah. Good question from Devin. If you have anything else you wanted to say, Ben, sorry.
No, I was going to say, I remember talking to a Dominican scout, and he was like, I love reading Baseball America because then I get to, I just get like a better feel for like improving my English when I'm writing reports and like what words and terms to use. And I was like, that's kind of cool. I was like, but just so you know, like we make up a lot of words too. So these aren't like real words, but within, you know, obviously the context of what we're doing, it makes sense. But it's funny to think, you know, like you're writing a report and you might be writing it for the front office or something in your second language. And you're just like throwing in words that are not even real English words, but actually like make sense for the specific job here.
Right. One of our other made up words here at Baseball America, it's not a made up word, a made up term, but personal cheese ball. We have a question about personal cheese balls here from Travis on Blue Sky. He asked, who are your biggest personal cheese ball hits? And for people who are not aware, I don't know the origin of this. I think it was with Jim Callis or John Manuel. You can educate me on the actual origin, but I'm glad
I believe it was John. Yeah.
Yeah. But basically a personal cheese ball is someone you like better than where they're ranked or where they're perceived. Typically it's a player who is not like a top, like if you said, oh, Dylan Cruz is my personal cheese ball in the 2023 draft, you might get looked at oddly because like everyone liked Dylan Cruz and acknowledged him. Typically it is a player who is further down draft boards or not a very prominent name that you're just very high on, one of your favorites. If you want to add any more to like the definition or how you think of a personal cheese ball before we get into some of our personal cheese ball hits, feel free. But that's how I think of it, at least.
I believe the origins of the term, and any historians can correct me if I'm inaccurate here, but it's also something, or a player you probably like a lot more than you really should, I believe was the idea of like, oh, I like these cheese balls a little more than I should. So yeah, it shouldn't be somebody who's like a highly ranked player. It's more just like a little bit more off the beaten path, a little bit, somebody a little bit more obscurity where you're like, man, I just like this guy way too much. I like this guy way more than everybody else. And it, you know, if it's somebody who's like a top 100 or top 10 prospect in an organization, probably not that guy.
So what would your cutoff be for personal cheese ball? Because I feel like there are definitely different cutoffs you could have for pro guys, for guys in the draft. We talk about this on the draft podcast too. Like for a while at the beginning of the year, Peter was talking about how Cade Anderson was his personal cheese ball. Well, we had him ranked outside of the top 80, but at the end of the day, like he was one of the top pitchers on the board. So like that's a personal cheese ball that hit for him in season. But you could also say that maybe we had him too far down the board. Maybe a top 100 draft prospect shouldn't count at all. Maybe it's like first round is the cutoff. So it's definitely a gray area in terms of what can really count. It does feel like one of those things where you kind of know it when you see it rather than any hard and fast rule. But if you have any, please throw them out. Because I've got some guys, some of whom I like that I know don't count as personal cheese balls who have hit. And then maybe a few other names that can count. But I'm curious if you have a cutoff for like the draft side.
A cutoff? No, I mean, I don't think it can be a top 100 prospect like that. That's I don't know. I'll leave it to John to make the judiciary ruling on that one.
Yeah, John, but, if you're listening, give us a hard and fast line. Yeah, I would say one of the recent ones for me, and I don't know if we can qualify this as a hit yet, but he's trending in the right direction. But I did have Texas left-handed pitcher Dayson Hill as a sleeper candidate heading into last year's spring before the season started. I don't believe we had him ranked top 100, but he was a player who, just after seeing him in the summer, I really liked the slider he had at the time. I loved the frame. He threw quality strikes, but he was just this really thin, lanky player who was topping out around like 92, 93. And I was like, oh, if he gets stronger, starts throwing harder, I could see everything kind of tick up. And he kind of did that during the spring and then has also continued to pitch well in pro ball. This is a Twins 69th overall pick in 2024, signed for $2 million. He is one, again, I don't think it qualifies as a hit, but I remember really liking him. I've got some other names I can throw out, like from drafts a while back. Like I always really did like Tyler Soderstrom, but again, I don't know that he really counts as a personal cheese ball because he was always a pretty prominent name over the showcase circuit. I was very, very high on his hitterish traits at the time. Even if he had to move off catcher, like he's panned out and been the sort of player I expected him to be. Another one who I'm not sure really counts because he's just too prominent. But James Wood is a guy who I would say I was like really high on even after he fell. Maybe this gets to the example of like players you like more than you should, because James Wood did not have a good spring, but I was just like, I maintained my like high stock on him because I'd seen him perform so well the summer before. But again, I think like both these two are two high examples. Like I think they're both too prominent to really count as official personal cheese ball status. But do you have any good examples?
I mentioned Michael Brantley earlier on the show. I always did like him, and he was like, he's playing like outfield / like first base at one point in his minor league career. He had like no power, but just a good swing, made a lot of contact. I remember being high on him. Him and Stephen Kwan, maybe some similarities as prospects, at least just in terms of the pure bat to ball skills. Neither guy was like ever super highly regarded. On the pitching side, I remember back in the day seeing Daryl Thompson, who's like, I believe, I mean, he got to the big leagues. He was originally, he was a later round pick out of high school by the Montreal Expos. And I'm pretty sure he's still playing independent ball or maybe winter ball somewhere right now, which is kind of crazy because he must be like 40. Let me look it up. He just turned 40 years old. So, but I remember watching him like pop up when he was in double A and having this like great season. And he stuck around for in the big leagues a very, very short amount of time. So I think that's probably a good definition of a cheese ball for me, but he's still throwing.
Yeah, nice. Okay. Cool. Trying to see if I have any other. Nah, all the other ones I have are probably more prominent names. Okay. What other question you want to get into? Got plenty here to pick from.
Let's see. Brewster Tizzy on X asks, seemingly every draft, we see some arms drafted after the first round explode up rankings and become high-end pitching prospects. Nolan McLean, Bubba Chandler, Mizorowski, Tolley, Tong, Gage Jump, etc. Mm-hmm. Which non-first-round arms from the 2025 class have the best chance to see similar huge rises?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I almost mentioned Nolan McLean as like a personal cheese ball type, but he was never really in that tier. But I always really liked him as a pitcher and wished he just pitched. And it's looking really good that he's just pitching. So good example. You know, what's interesting to me about this group of names, what I'm looking at here are like three profiles maybe. And if there are other traits that jump out to you from this group, throw them out here. But like with Nolan McLean, which Bubba are we referring to? Bubba Chandler?
Bubba Chandler, yeah, right?
Yeah, I assume so. But like Bubba Chandler, he kind of ranked in the first round. He just got paid later because of the demographics of the draft. But I see your point. Like both Nolan McLean and Bubba Chandler were noted for like being athletic two-way players. And so I think there are maybe some players you could point to that when they focus just on one side, there are some strides you can take because of that. With Jacob Mizorowski, it's a player with tremendous pure stuff who just did not have the strikes in control. And I'm not even sure like how good the stuff was when he was drafted. Certainly not as good as it is now, but like big pure stuff players who, if they can get in a player development system that can rein in the strikes. And then with the last three, really all those guys stand out for just the quality of their fastballs. They had really outlier fastball shapes at the time. So maybe if we're trying to find other players of that demo, we can look to some of those sorts of profiles. When I'm pulling up pitchers from last year's draft who maybe fit that, like one of the first names I go to is Michael Lombardi, who the Royals drafted in the second round, 61st overall, signed for just under $1.3 million. He was a two-way player in college, made a lot of contact as a hitter, good runner, center fielder. Legitimate college two-way player, should probably be a pitcher only moving forward. And he's got a pair of pitches between the fastball and the curveball that could be legitimate plus offerings. Sits around 94, touches 97. The curveball has really impressive depth and bite. And I feel like this is the exact sort of like profile you would maybe point to and say, hey, there's a lot of athleticism here. There's a lot of raw, pure stuff. We maybe haven't seen what could be his peak in terms of the control and command department. And if you're a strong pitching development system, there's just a lot of, as Peter Flaherty would say, there's a lot of clay to work with here and to mold. So he would be one of the first pitchers that I point out. I've got a few others, but I'm curious if you have some names as well, Ben.
The top one who jumps to mind for me would be Angel Cervantes. But I think he's probably asking about guys who actually signed. I mean, he's
right.
I think he's going to have a great pitcher at UCLA and probably make an impact right away. But obviously the Pirates didn't sign him. But I think about some of the other high school arms this year. Landon Harmon, Nationals drafted him, just long, lean, like 6'4", 6'5", super easy delivery, up to, what, like 98, 99, something like that. It's, you know, moves down the mound really well. A lot of athleticism you can see in his delivery. Big time fastball. Would like to see some more sharpness with the breaking ball. See what the new Nationals development group can do with that. He'd be one. I think another one would be Frank Chiarone. He's definitely an up arrow arm. Yep. Brewers drafted. High school lefty from New Jersey. Young for the class. He was 17 on draft. Everything was like just kind of kept ticking up and up and up with him. Up to like 94 miles an hour. Good release traits, good extension, moves well down the mound, probably a couple more ticks of velocity still to come. And that big, sweepy slider, 3,000 plus RPM. He'd be another one. And I think River Hamilton, too, is kind of a sneakier one later round Padres draft pick. Just like a lot of good projection arrows with him, where I was hoping maybe a little bit more would have come by his senior year. But, you know, 6'3", up to 95, still more space to fill out. Like solid secondary stuff, not knockout stuff, but definitely some traits to work with there.
I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
I'm glad you hit on the high school names because the entirety of my list was from the college demographics. We get a good cross-section here. But another name I'd point to, and really Tennessee probably has a number of options that could fit here just because they had so much firepower on their pitching staff that was drafted beyond the first round. But A.J. Russell, who the Rangers drafted in the second round, he has some of these fastball traits that I feel like are just going to give him a solid floor. And then if he can maybe develop some more consistent secondaries, take a step forward. He also had some injury questions previously, hasn't really pitched in a long-term starter role, just given the sort of injuries and how he was used early on in his career. But his fastball might have been one of the better pitches in the class just from the low release point, low three-quarter slot. Like, he's got a really unique movement profile with that pitch on top of it being up into the upper 90s. Couple other names I'd mentioned, Cam Leiter out of FSU, second round pick by the Dodgers. Really purely based on health, if Cam Leiter can come back and be healthy, maybe that alone will be enough for him to just reemerge. Because if he was healthy, I don't think that anyone in the industry would have said he's not a first round talent. He's got loud stuff across the board, multiple high spin breaking balls that could be plus offerings, been up to 99. The fastball has good shape. I mean, at his best, he's shown solid control, but I think when you're looking at Cam Leiter, it's health question marks. It's like, what is the quality of the strikes going to be moving forward? Durability questions. If any of those questions get answered, you're looking at a really exciting arm. And then another one, because I was in the second round for a lot of these guys, in the fourth round, the Rockies drafted Riley Kelly. And maybe this is not great to choose any Rockies pitcher because they really seem to struggle if they're getting up to the major leagues with the Rockies. But Riley Kelly has, again, really unique fastball shape. It's not the hardest fastball of any that I mentioned here, but it's got great riding life. He's got a super high spin curveball in the upper 70s that just has a ton of biting action. So two plus pitches between the fastball and curveball there. Another player who, like, if he can add a little bit more control in pro ball, you can maybe see him take a jump. So those would be a few names I'd throw out there, but I think a really good question. Yeah, what else? What else, Ben? You can continue to lead us here.
All right. Cloku44 on Instagram says, who has the best command out of the college and prep crop in the 2026 draft? I can answer some of the, I think, the top guys on the high school side. Three guys jump out to me in particular. One is Carson Bolamon.
He was the first guy I had on my list.
Yeah, left-handed pitcher from South Carolina, committed to Wake Forest. If we're maybe not necessarily just fastball command, but command of his entire arsenal.
The secondaries. It's crazy how much he throws those pitches for strikes.
It's extremely impressive. Yeah, he's got curveball, slider. They're both really good pitches, and he executes them so well. He lands them wherever he wants, in the zone when he needs to, using it for a chase pitch. Good stuff. I mean, he's up to 96 from the left side. I think he, if he wanted to enroll early at Wake Forest, which I'm sure they would love for him to do, I think he could pitch in a
yeah, they're probably terrified he's not going to get there now.
They should be. he's probably going to go pretty early. But well, you know, we'll see with high school pitching. He'd be one. Coleman Borthwick, who's a gigantic right-handed pitcher slash third baseman too, in Florida. He's a guy where, I mean, it's big, big stuff. It's power stuff. He looks like a Lance Lynn or something like that kind of body. Yep. On the mound. So you see him and you're like, oh, like, all right, this guy's going to come in and throw really hard. But actually, well, he does, but also he has some of the best control in the class. He's a really good athlete. Surprised me, I'll say, just how well he moves and repeats his delivery for such a big guy. So he's another guy. And then Caden Wachter, another yep. guy in Florida, right-handed pitcher, Florida State commit. His dad, Doug, pitched in the big league. So not a big surprise there. Just everything is very polished. And I mean, if we're going to use the term pitcherish, I think it applies to him. He just does everything really easy, very, very high strikes, very low walks, just mm-hmm. a very polished pitcher on the mound.
Yeah, those are all good names there. One of the names that I kind of thought about that we don't currently have at the very top of our class, but I'm curious what you think about his just strikes and pitchability. But I was scanning down the list just to find some deeper names. But Colton Brady, right-handed pitcher out of TNXL Academy in Florida. I got to see him at the Baseball Factory All-America game. He was the most impressive just pure pitcher command type at that event. We've got him currently slated to be in like the top 200 range on our board, so maybe less prominent, but I was really impressed with his strikes. And he's also a really interesting pitcher because he's 6'5", tons of room to fill out, so really young for the class as well. I'm not sure how much you saw of him, yeah. but his pitcherish traits were impressive to me. On the college side, one of the first players that I went to was Ryan Marrone at NC State, and this was a player who was a back of the 500 type coming out of high school. He was sort of this like filled out left-handed pitcher who didn't have great stuff, but kind of like you were talking about with Carson Bolleman, like his feel for his secondaries and his ability to land those pitches for strikes at a young age was always impressive. He didn't have quite the walk rate I maybe would have expected from him in 2024, but that dropped from 9.7% last year to 5.4% in 2025. Across 14 starts. And I just think his feel to mix and match, his entire mix, and his feel for his changeup in particular stands out to me. Further up the board, a player who stood out to me when doing a little bit more work on him this offseason was Cameron Flukey at Coastal Carolina. He's one of the top overall pitchers in the class. He has real stuff, but his fastball command in particular was a real standout number for me. I mean, he threw that pitch for strikes at a 74% clip while throwing it more than 95 miles per hour on average. He also had a walk rate south of 6% this spring. He lands the slider for strikes at a heavy clip as well. So those were two on the college side that stood out to me, but that's a decent number of arms here in both demos.
Yeah, the other two high school players to at least consider here, one would be Logan Schmidt, a lefty from mm-hmm. California, who reclassed from 2027 to 2026. He threw a ton of strikes this summer, threw a ton of strikes. The fastball just threw a ton of strikes overall, sells the changeup really well off that fastball. Mm-hmm. He had a really, really strong summer. And then so did Jensen Hirschkorn, who's another pitcher from California, gigantic right-handed pitcher. I don't think anybody had a better summer than him. He was totally dominant, and he's 6'7". So like normally we're not talking about 6'7" guys in right. this category, but it's a pretty easy delivery. I saw him early in the summer. He got off to a good start, throwing a lot of strikes there. I mean, I don't know how much you think of it as just his stuff is just so dominant. He just dominates everybody that like how much of it is actually command versus just how good his stuff is. But one of the higher strike rates for any high school pitcher this year, and just totally overmatched everybody on at some pretty big events.
Yeah, he did. I think like he was probably the single biggest riser on our draft board from pre-summer to the October update. So another good one to highlight there. Got a good combination of like strikes and power stuff. Like sometimes you look in the draft class and there are pitchers who throw strikes, but they just don't have a lot of stuff to go with it. But we just listed off a lot of the players who also have some of the best like pure stuff and just big time velocity in this class. I think the pitching in this class is just really strong across the board at this stage. So it's a good group. Okay, let's go to any of these jumping out to you, Ben? Take it from the top.
One from Travis on Blue Sky asking, are perfect game and the concept of quote elite and quote youth players largely a scam that feasts on delusional parents that think their kid is the next MLB star? Has it been good or harmful for baseball development in the U.S.? I think it just depends what you're looking at. Like Perfect Game is a gigantic enterprise that runs tournaments and they run showcases for amateur players focused on the high school players, the high school player and below, I guess I should say, or PBR, Prep Baseball Report. Those are two of the biggest players in that space. And I would say Perfect Game is the biggest one. They hold a lot of good events. The Jupiter being the big event in the fall, I think, is a great one. It's heavily attended by scouts, college coaches. They have other tournaments throughout the summer, too, that are especially useful for college coaches, I would say, for mm-hmm. them to get eyes on players once they're entering their junior year. So say that this past summer, the 2027s, the next year, the 2028s, it'll be. And then they have showcases, too. So the bigger ones would be their national showcase that they have every year in the summer at Chase Field in Arizona. Obviously, their All-America game at the end of the year, or at the end of the summer, I should say. Junior National Showcase, a whole bunch of other ones. And there's no shortage of like regional mm-hmm. showcases, regional tournaments that are available throughout the year across the country. You know, is that good or bad? It's a very broad question. I think it's hard to answer. I think for the best players in the country, whether we're talking about draft prospects or just players you can play at a high level Division I college program, I think it's good to play against mm-hmm. good competition that's going to challenge you. I think that's going to make you a better player. Not every tournament you play in is going to offer that, but whether it's Perfect Game tournament like the UBC or USA Baseball for their national team championships or something outside of those companies like Area Code Games, mm-hmm. You know, you can get a better barometer for your talent level and you can develop more as a player just by facing good competition, especially if you're not seeing that during your high school season, which is the case for, you know, the majority of players. So in that respect, yeah, having the best players from all over the country compete against players who are at their level, I think that's a positive for baseball and it's a positive for their development.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the ability to play against players all over the country and to face levels of competition that you would otherwise not be exposed to is just generally good for your development as a player. I also think that like anything, you should like know what you're signing up for and be aware of like the money that you're spending. If you think that like going to every single event is going to just automatically get you exposure, automatically make you better, that's maybe too broad of a commitment to it. But yeah, I think that in general, it's very easy to dunk on like the travel ball culture, the showcase culture that we have, but kind of like echoing just everything you said, like it can be very beneficial for players for both development and exposure, and just maybe just be a little bit more educated on like what you're actually spending your money on if you're making the decisions for your family in that space. Like there certainly are going to be events that are probably not worth your money, but I think having the ability and the options to participate in these sort of tournaments and these showcases is a good thing by and large. Ultimately, you have to decide like what's too much, what's becoming overuse. Like if you're playing multiple sports, like you're not going to take advantage of all this. And I think that there still can be benefits for your baseball career by playing multiple sports at the high school level. So it's a very nuanced answer and question. Yeah, there's probably some events that are maybe not worth your specific time. But I'd also say, too, like, I don't think travel ball is beneficial only for the players who have, like, a career at the next level. Like, depending on what you have at your high school level, like, for me personally, I played travel ball for one summer, maybe two summers, and it was the most enjoyable and fun baseball experience I think I had in my entire life. And so, like, in the, like, very small scope of it that I did, it was a great experience for me just for, like, having fun and playing baseball with my friends and, like, going to play against people I wouldn't have played against. Like, my baseball career ended when I was in high school, but I wouldn't say that, like, I was scammed. I had a blast for multiple summers on this team that was just really well coached, really good people that I was around with, like just hanging out with my friend. Like, even if it's just that, you know, it still can be valuable. So yeah, I do think it generally gets, it's easy to demonize it on Twitter or the internet.
Yeah. People spend $5,000 to $10,000 to take their family to Disney World for right. a week. Like what's the ROI? On right. that, I don't know, but you're going for the experience in those cases. And if your mm-hmm. expectation is, oh, if I go to this regional elite all state super awesome show, like, well, okay, like don't have the proper expectations in line. But if not, I agree, like not everybody's doing this to get to the major leagues. Like there are people
right.
who just want to go and
play the sport for fun.
Yeah. With their friends, with their teammates. So, so the other area would be like showcases, right? So the showcases are separate from mm-hmm. tournaments, like where you're just going for yourself. You're just going to try to, whether, get exposure, whether it's to, depending on the event, whether it's to major league scouts or college coaches. And we get asked, like, are these showcases worth it? And again, that one depends. And I'll echo what you said by saying there are zero showcases and there are zero events in the world that are must attend events
right.
for players. You do not have to do any of them. Some of them are useful. I think if you get invited to the Areaco Games or East Coast Pro, those are two marquee events that are run by MLB scouts. So I would recommend generally that people, mm-hmm. Players go to those. Now they're back to back. Maybe you don't want to do both and travel all over and all that. Cause there's a lot of costs associated and just, you want to manage your body and all that.
Yep.
But those are good ones. These other showcases that are run by, PG or PBR, are they worth it? That also depends. I mean, I go to the, to their junior national, to PG's junior national showcase every year. And I go because I get value from it, just trying to see a lot of players in one place. And a lot of them are top players from around the country. So if you're a rising junior or a 2028 player next summer, like there are other events that might help you get recognized by colleges, especially in your area. PBR runs the Future Games. That's become a huge college recruiting event every summer. Now, if you're 14 years old or you're a freshman in high school, and you want to go to a showcase, I would say, why? Like, yeah. I mean, there's no MLB scouts who are going to be looking at you there. Under the current rules, where colleges can't recruit players until August 1st of their junior year, they're not looking at you. If you want to go and have the experience, like, all right, that's fine. Again, I'm not going to tell any family or parents like how you should spend your money. If you go ahead and do it, I guess if you want, but also just don't expect anything to happen from it either.
Right. Yeah.
On the delusional parents part, like, yeah, that's always, that's just always going to exist. But also, again, like, nobody's coercing or forcing anybody to like at gunpoint to like play at these
events. I don't know, like, man, Ben, some of these travel ball teams take winning these tournaments seriously.
Yeah, I mean, if you choose to play for this travel team or that showcase at PG or PBR or wherever, like, okay, like that's your decision. But I think, especially if you have, you know, if you're at the level where you have aspirations to or the talent to play pro ball, hopefully most of the players have, like, you know, have advisors, which are it's a whole other topic where more and more players have agents / advisors when they're younger and younger and younger. And I think they can be helpful just guiding through that process of like which events are useful to go to. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially for college camps, I think if that's what you want to do, like if you have interest in playing at a school, I would try to go to one of their camps so that their coaching staff can see you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a good way to do it too.
Cool. Okay, let's circle back to another question from Travis on Blue Sky. He had a lot of good ones that he threw at us. He says, who are the biggest draft busts you guys can remember? And then he says, either personal misses or guys the industry missed out on. So you'll have more drafts to pull from than me. I would say two of my biggest personal misses to this point, players who I really liked that have just not panned out so far. The first is Kevin Parada, who I really liked as an underclassman in high school. And I feel like for a few years there, I was like, oh, one of my personal cheese balls has hit because he did work himself into like top of the class territory after a few years at Georgia Tech. He was one of the better pure hitters in his college class. And really, this 2022 college class has a lot of misses from like profiles that generally feel like the safest, like these proven college hitters with multiple years of high level production and power conferences. JJ Cooper recently had a piece just talking about just the number of misses that between the 2021 and 2022 draft classes, first round guys just being unprotected ahead of the Rule 5 at a higher rate. Parada is one of the names there who I'd say is a miss for me personally, because I was just very high on him, very bullish on him. I would have drafted him higher than where he went in that draft if it were me. Another notable miss for me, I would say, is Austin Martin. I was much more confident in him being a well-rounded offensive player than the player he has become. I'm not sure how much of that was because of COVID and just smaller sample during his draft year, but I was very, very bullish on Austin Martin at the time. I think I said like that pick, him going fifth overall to the Blue Jays, was like the steal of the draft at the time. I was super excited about it. That one certainly hasn't aged well. So those are two for me that I would say are misses at this stage.
We went, where did Austin Martin go? It was fifth overall.
Fifth overall. And we had him ranked number two in the class behind Spencer Torkelson, I believe. He was definitely top two. And when he fell to fifth, I was like, what is going on? Heston Kerstedt went second. He was kind of a little bit further off the board that year.
Well, I was going to say the guy who went right ahead of him, Asa Lacy, to the Royals would have to be one of the bigger busts, which like
that was the one player I had written down for industry bust outside of like me personally. But yeah, that one has not been the greatest.
No, I'm kind of like, all right, everybody, you know, kind of looked the other way on the 2020 draft, but like, man, he got into pro ball and it was just like zero strikes, got even like worse the next year. That one went off the rails really fast to take a guy.
Yeah, so his college career, so this is three seasons at Texas A&M, and then obviously in 2020 season was cut short. Right. He threw
Two seasons and a very shortened
two seasons and four starts. Yeah. But overall in college, here are his numbers. So this is 21 starts, 42 games total. So about half the time he was used as a starter in college. 2.07 ERA with 224 strikeouts and 68 walks in 152 innings. That translated to a 13.3 K per nine and a 4.0 walk per nine. In the minors, his two seasons in the minors, 7.09 ERA across 19 starts, 29 games, 80 innings. He had 114 strikeouts, 83 walks. So he had more walks than innings pitched. That's 12.8 K per nine, 9.3 walk per nine. Hard to imagine like that sort of jump in control command so quickly.
Yeah. Other guys I had, a lot of guys who I'm just looking at the very top of the draft. Like you go back to 2014, the top, it seems like another era entirely where the top two draft picks were high school pitchers.
Yeah. Brady Aiken. This is the draft that set back the demographic, right?
Brady Aiken goes number one overall to the Astros, doesn't sign due to issues with his physical. Number two, the Marlins draft Tyler Colick, second overall. That kind of guy in a draft today is just never going anywhere.
He's not going
near
in the first round. Yeah.
That high. Yeah. It's just the big physical, very hard throwing at a time where there wasn't as much velocity that's so widespread as
it is.
Yeah,
one of the hardest ever throwing high school pitchers at the time. I mean, still is in a really select group of like pitchers to have touched 102 miles per hour in high school. It's still just a handful of names.
Yeah, just lack of feel for secondary stuff, lack of strikes. The year before, I mean, Mark Appel, also in 2014, I should say, the next two picks after that were Carlos Rodon and Kyle Schwarber. So like,
yeah, those are good ones.
That kind of stings. But Mark Appel going number one overall to the Astros, especially when the number two pick in that draft was Chris Bryant.
Right.
For a college pitcher to go that high and then have, you know, basically do nothing in his, in terms of the value he delivered is pretty huge disappointment. Cole Stewart that year also going fourth overall to the Twins. I would throw in that another group of, I mean, he wasn't like a super hard throwing high school pitcher. It was, you know, more in the like advanced pitchability camp, but nothing ever really ended up materializing there. And then like the 08 and the 09 drafts, I mean, the 09 draft where you had Dustin Ackley, who
I was about to say, Steven Strasburg bust.
Well, he did
no, not
right.
at all. No, not at all. I thought you were going to stick with your 1-1s, but yeah, Dustin Ackley was such a college player.
Yeah, great, great college player. I mean, he had, you know, he had some like decent, he had a decent MLB career, but for what he did too, I mean, he was good in the minor leagues. Like, it wasn't like, oh, he came out and immediately was just like, terrible. I mean, he's a huge on base guy, but just never really materialized in the player you could expect him to be. We thought he'd more like Kyle Seager, and never turned out. But then you look at the two guys right behind him too. Padres took a high school outfielder, Donovan Tate at three. The Pirates kind of reach for Tony Sanchez, college catcher at number four. Tate always sticks out to me as like one of the archetype of super toolsy athletic high school prospects that people love, or sometimes college players too, but you know, obviously in his case, high school player,
the recent
excited about. And right. It's like, well, they do have to hit too.
The recent guys who fit in that bucket for me, is Austin Beck in 2017. He was like the first heartbreak, I think, that I really experienced in a professional capacity, because I did get to see him a little bit. I kind of started at BA that spring in 2017, and Austin Beck just was overflowing with physical tools and athleticism, and he just never hit at all. He was sixth overall to the A's in 2017. I don't know if you'd bucket Joe Adele to the same degree, because he does have a major league career, but that's a similar profile. And then maybe the biggest one of them all of this, at least in terms of like recent memory when I've been here, but Keone Cavaco, what draft was he? 2019. And this is like further down the board. A lot of the guys you're talking about are like top 10 picks, but Keone Cavaco in 2019 as the 13th overall pick just had massive tools, was this huge up arrow player during the spring. And then it feels like he just never could figure it out in pro ball.
Yeah. You know, Tim Beckham went number one overall to the Rays out of high school, and he did have probably like 6-7 seasons in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. But I think, I guess he had one couple good years, but otherwise, for a guy who drafted number one overall right ahead of Pedro Alvarez, Eric Hosmer, Brian Mattis, and then Buster Posey. Yeah. That stings a little bit. And then right after Buster Posey, the Marlins drafted Kyle Skipworth, who was just like a supposed to be this super advanced high school catcher who like very briefly got to the big leagues. But like I remember seeing him after he first signed or his first year out in Greensboro, which was low A for the Marlins at the time. And it was like, ooh, did not have a good year in a park that's a very good place for hitters to hit. And mm-hmm. you could pretty quickly tell like, oh, this is not like things kind of look right, especially behind the plate, I thought. And then offensively,
just looked overmatched.
Yeah, I think not a lot of teams want to draft high school catching super high.
Oh man, it's a terrifying demographic for the industry. We haven't had the last few years, we've not had the strongest high school catching crops for them to pick from, even to like just see like how willing are you. Like I would be very curious if in the next few years we got I don't know if it needs to be like a generational type of prospect, but like a very clear, like top 15 type. Like what's the ceiling for a high school catcher at this stage in the era of the draft we have right now? Like the highest recent high school catcher, probably Blake Mitchell going inside the top 10. Yeah. I mean, some of the guys who've gone like mid or back of the first round have panned out pretty well. Soderstrom, Bo Naylor, Rafi Velazquez is looking good at this stage. Maybe too early to make a call on that one. And he's also not catching anymore. So if you don't want to count him, that fits. But yeah, definitely a demo that is a bit risky.
Yeah. See what happens with Will Brick this year.
Yeah. He's exciting. Okay, Ben, I'm not sure how much more time you have to give or how many more of these you want to go through. But if there are any other ones that pique your interest, we can continue plugging along. What you got?
Matt Stromer on Instagram asks, is it too early for Ronnie L. Rodriguez, the Cardinals catching prospect, to consider switching positions? Yes. Definitely. I mean, he's very much an offensive-oriented prospect. You're banking on the hit and especially the power with him, and he's going to still have to clean things up defensively. But this is an 18-year-old catcher. I'd give him a long, long runway. Like, it's not a total train wreck back there. You know, ultimately maybe he does move off the position. We'll see, but like give him a lot more time to work with your pro development, pro coaches. We've seen a lot of guys get a lot better defensively mm-hmm. from the age of 18 to 21, or sometimes college guys when they come in at 21 until, you know, they're 23, 24, getting closer to the big leagues. So, can always, if it's not working out, or for, you know, you're the Giants and you draft Buster Posey and you have Pablo Sandoval behind the plate mm-hmm. and tell him, all right, go pick up a third baseman's mitt and
right.
see if you can swing it over there, or maybe first base, corner outfield, something like that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say way too soon to do that.
Yeah, the players that like are in a position where you maybe want to be aggressive to move them off catcher, like you have to be at such a different level offensively. I feel like the progression or the big league readiness of your bat has to be such a huge difference to you, or like the development timeline has to be so far off, or if it's just like a player like Bryce Harper, if you just don't want to worry about the durability issues that might come with it and you know that his bat is like franchise altering, it maybe makes sense to be more aggressive to move those players off just so you can get them to the big leagues. But I would say with almost all players, like you're not really hurting too much by giving them more player development time, especially like you said, we're talking about an 18-year-old. He's caught 85 games, official games at catcher, 708 total innings. And he's played four games at the high level. So yeah, it does feel a little bit premature to move him off the position again, especially since, like, I still think catcher is the single position that teams can help players improve. So much about, like, catching, it's just the reps and, like, the want to at the position more so than maybe some other positions on the diamond. And we do see teams so regularly turn around defensive reputations in a pretty quick fashion. So I'm with you there.
All right. And then we got a question. Jake Stoller on Instagram asks, who are the 2027 Northeast high school arms we should be looking for?
This is a very specific question.
Well, if you go up to the state of Vermont, you will find the best, or I mean the best high school player in New England, or just probably the Northeast in general. This in 2027, Caden McCarthy, who's a 6-foot right-handed pitcher, really athletic, good operation on the mound. I saw him up to 94 over the summer, and then at the very end of the year, it's up to like 96, 97. It's a really fast arm, a ton of arm side run on his fastball, feel for a changeup, like enough feel for a slider in there. So he's not like your, 6'3", 6'4", pitcher that typically goes high up in the draft, at least on the high school side. But I think McCarthy has a chance to still go very high because it's a really fast arm. It's big time stuff with a lot of movement, a lot of wiggle to everything he does. He's a Tennessee commit. Then you've got,
I will say before you move on from McCarthy,
yeah,
I really hope that he sticks in Vermont, because it's very common, I feel like, for players in this area to maybe move somewhere south, go to a different school, either to get more innings, more runway in the spring, face better competition. Like, I wouldn't hold it against him, obviously, because it could make a lot of sense just for his career, and it is such a common route that it wouldn't be surprising. But it just would be cool to see a Vermont prospect this high up a draft board, because I can't really think of one off the top of my head at this level. I don't know what the actual record is for like Vermont prepster in the draft, but I would imagine he's got a chance to be in a very, very, very unique group.
Owen Kellington a few years back, went maybe like fifth round or I forget where, but I think McCarthy's.
He went fourth round, 102nd overall to the Pirates in 2021.
I think McCarthy is a better prospect now than Kellington was the day he was drafted. So, I think he's, I'm sure IMG Academy or any other one of the comparable type program is looking for him, whether it's down south or somewhere else in New England with maybe a more competitive program than what he's going to be. That plays more competitive competition, I should say, than what he's going to face in Vermont, where a lot of guys are probably not seeing anything much more than 70-something miles an hour. But that's the good thing with pitching, at least, is like it's not ideal to go in and evaluate a guy throwing against hitters who just have zero chance of making contact with him. But you can at least evaluate a pitcher, I think, easier that way, independent of the competition he's facing, more so than a hitter who's just facing guys who are throwing 68-mile-an-hour fastballs.
Yeah, Kellington is the guy that you'd point to. If our draft database is to be trusted, he's the highest drafted high school player out of the state in the history of the draft at 102nd. So if we get him to stick in the state, if we get McCarthy to stay there, he's got 100 picks to work with if he wants to set some draft records.
We'll go see him maybe next spring too.
Yeah.
Owen Burns, lefty in Massachusetts, was a 2028 really all summer and then just reclassified at the end. Good looking lefty, Auburn commit. Derek Yormick from New York is a Vanderbilt commit, right-handed pitcher up to 94. And then a lefty, Cooper Birdie from New Jersey, who was a Tennessee commit. Now he's uncommitted after coaching changes there. Obviously, Tony Vitello and their pitching coach, Frank Anderson, leaving. So he's now one of the better uncommitted prospects in the 2027 class. So he's kind of tucked into the back of our top 100 right now, but, you know, 6 foot lefty, can touch 91, really good feel for his secondary stuff, especially like he can miss bats with the slider. He can miss bats with the changeup. So, weapons to get swing and miss against hitters from both sides of the plate.
Nice. Okay, so there you go. A very, very specific answer to a very specific question. That's what we do here on the Future Projection Podcast. Get in the weeds on prospects.
Yeah.
I think that kind of runs it down the list for me, Ben. We've kind of hit on most of the questions that we have here. Are you good?
Yeah. Yeah. What's
nice?
You sticking around locally or for Thanksgiving or?
Yeah, Maddie's got to work this year, so we'll do a little local Thanksgiving celebration. You know, it's been good practice for us. I'll say we're probably put in a position where we have to cook more of the Thanksgiving dishes than we otherwise would have, which has been fun. Maybe in the future it'll pay off. We got some practice at the player development side of things, like you were talking about. Maybe our turkey can get to a 60 grade.
You're working on the complex
exactly,
level, working
exactly.
at the backfields where nobody's really watching right now.
And 100%. It's going to pay off. It's going to pay off.
Yeah.
Well, how about
just,
you?
Yeah. Just staying around here. Nothing, nice. Nothing too fancy.
Cool. Well, this is a fun mailbag episode. Well, we take questions regularly. You guys don't have to wait for a mailbag specific episode. If you've got something you want us to answer or tackle, you can shoot us those questions on social media or via email. It's futureprojection@baseballamerica.com. All of the links and the ways you can reach out to us are in all the show notes, every single podcast episode. So just check those out. If you have anything to say, any comments, feedback, if you want to leave a review, wherever you're listening to the podcast, those are always really appreciated. Ben has made a solemn vow to read those to you. I guess if they're positive enough, they'll be on the podcast. So.
I didn't say I was going to read every single one on the air, just to make a disclaimer here. But
cool.
But no, we always appreciate those.
Yeah, so thank you guys. Thanks for just supporting BA in general. Hope you all have a great Thanksgiving, wherever you might be at. Hope you get some good quality family time, get some good food, throw some 80s down on the plate. That'd be tremendous to hear. So for Ben, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody. See you next time.